that's her life, and instead of kind of just straightforwardly going and requesting mercy for the Jews from the king, she instead invites the king and Haman to a banquet. And then he agrees, they come to the banquet, and he asks her again what her petition is, and instead of asking there, she again says, ask him to come to a second banquet the following day. And we talked some about kind of the bravery that she showed in doing this, and also why, you know, she might have done this. You know, why it was a good plan. Some of the potential advantages to that, and why kind of it would give the king kind of a sense of importance. He obviously was someone who liked banquets, and so kind of a way to get him on her good side and to build up this kind of building towards a situation where she would have a good chance of success. And now we're going to see in the rest of chapter 5 and 6 and another reason why, you know, this was a good plan. And this is because it allows God time to act. And we'll see kind of how God is working alongside to lead to deliverance for his people. So before we move then into the second half of chapter 5, I wanted to see if anyone else had any more comments. We kind of cut off right in the middle of the discussion of this kind of a first banquet request for a second banquet. So if anyone else had any comments about that portion. So. No? Okay. So, Wade, could I get you to read starting in verse 9 through the end of chapter 5, please? So Haman's quite a swell guy, isn't he? You know, just who you would want to be at a dinner party with, I'm sure. So it's pretty amazing how full of himself he is in this section. But before we talk about Haman, we get another chance here to see Mordecai's character, and I think it's pretty remarkable that, despite all that he's gone through, he's still, you know, sticking to his principles here, and he's refusing to show Haman the reverence that he wants. And you know, what do you think it is that's allowing him to continue to stand fast even when all these forces are kind of pushing on him? I mean, I think that's definitely, you can see that he is a man of strong faith in this. And, you know, I personally also think that that's, you know, what's giving him the strength and the confidence to stand up in this situation. So how can we kind of build that same perseverance and faith in ourselves? You know, what are, because I mean, we may not face the same sort of, you know, life-threatening trials that Mordecai faces, but we face situations where we are tempted to not persevere. Right, I think that, I mean, that's a good point, and it's through challenges that you're going to build your faith up. So it's kind of, I mean, if you're never challenged, you're never really going to grow. But if you don't take advantage of, or I guess you can take advantage of challenges that you face, but you can also be kind of putting yourself out there in positions where you may face more challenges than if you just sit back and never get outside of your comfort zone. And so you can grow that way as well. Right. He had courage, but it wasn't the kind of, I mean, it was the kind of courage that made him willing to go back and face the situation, you know, again and again and still stand strong. So, yes. Well, he certainly knew that he had an influence on Esther, too. And he, you know, maybe knowing that she was risking her life, you know, would probably give him a strength there as well, I think. So I'm reminded of, thinking of verses that we can look to kind of draw this type of strength in our faith. Romans chapter 5. Verses 1 through 4 is something that I kind of look to, you know, when trying to prepare for a situation like this. So, starting in verse 1 of Romans chapter 5, "Therefore, since we have been justified through faith, we have peace with God through our Lord Jesus Christ, through whom we have gained access by faith into this grace in which we now stand. And we rejoice in this hope of the glory of God. Not only so, but we also rejoice in our sufferings, because we know that suffering produces perseverance, perseverance character, and character hope. And hope does not disappoint us, because God has poured out His love into our hearts by the Holy Spirit, whom He has given us." And so I think this touches on what Bob had talked about this building up of perseverance and character and hope. You can see kind of how going through trials like this would build up your character and allow you to withstand something, you know, like this. You're not just going to, if you're never, you know, facing challenges and never building yourself up, and then you immediately are faced with something as vast as what Mordecai was faced with, it's going to be very challenging.
Thank you.
Well, and we can look to the fact that we've been given the Holy Spirit to help us and to sustain us here, and also to the example of Jesus and what he went through. I mean, in Hebrews 12, it talks about look to Jesus and the things that he went through and draw strength and hope from that example. And so not only do we have these Old Testament characters that we can look to as examples of faith, but we have Jesus as kind of the ultimate example of that. I don't know. Does anyone else have any favorite passages that they look to draw to kind of build their faith and draw strength when either preparing for or dealing with challenges like this? Yeah, and that's a great one. I mean, it points to Jesus as kind of the anchor for, you know, our faith. Yeah. Anyone else? That's true. Good one. Yeah. All right, so on to Haman here. So what are some of the things that Haman brags about here in chapter 5 of Esther? There's a lot of them, so. Yes. Kids, what was that? Right, he's being honored by, he's been elevated above all the other nobles and officials. Right. Yeah. So he's got lots of things that he's proud of himself for. And what is it that's irking him despite all of these wonderful things that are going on? Right. It's still this one guy that will not bow down to him. All these blessings that he has are not giving him any comfort. So we've got a big bundle of kind of characteristics here that we could potentially not want to show. So let's try to separate out some of them. So what are some of the characteristics that Haman shows here? Okay, pride. Yep. Not sure I can spell arrogant. Greed, yes. Right. I guess lack of gratitude. Yes, that's a good one. I already started writing this, though. So. That counts as ungrateful too. Yes, and probably, I mean, I don't know that he could have hate for just him without having, you know, a more general kind of a hateful attitude. Oh, yeah. Another one. I'm not sure I can spell. Yes. That's a good point. If you wanted to kind of summarize it all up, it's kind of self-absorption or selfishness. So. Is there a word that I can put on here that summarizes that? I can't write all that. What? Ambitious. Yeah, that's a good one. well, there's probably more, but I think that. Oh, did you have another one? We can put another one. Yeah, he does demonstrate that he's cruel. In the, yeah. All right, we'll put that on here. Okay, so Haman's kind of such an extreme case that it's easy to read this and say, wow, that guy's just way out there. There's no way any of us could ever even come close to that. But I do think there some of these sins are easy to get sucked into, even, you know, maybe not the radical extreme that Haman is. Well, and power can exacerbate whatever flaws we may have. You know, you face greater temptation as you move up. So. Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, it's an interesting question that we don't know the answer to, so why Haman got to this position. And it's, you can certainly speculate that he may have had some good qualities that got him there.
I think as far as government goes, ruthless people tend to do really well. And there's plenty of examples of people that don't have a lot of redeeming qualities that become great leaders. In a worldly sense,
well, and certainly it seems that at this time, people who could kind of manipulate the truth and manipulate people got ahead, which I'm not sure if that's still the case today or not. But yeah. Maybe, I don't know. I might be naive here, I don't know. So he certainly demonstrated a good ability to manipulate the situation with the king. We have a word for it. So. So I mean, we could spend, you know, a whole class talking about just the ways these different sins can infiltrate our lives. I think the one that jumped out at me, I think, was the lack of gratitude. Just the not realizing that all these blessings you have aren't, you know, just your own doing, I guess. And I guess the inability to be content with the things you've been given. And I think that's something that's easy to lose sight of. You know. Right. It's easy to get caught up in reacting to things and just focusing on whatever crisis has popped up in our lives and not. And I think you kind of have to remind yourself, you know, how much you've been blessed and how these things that you have are gifts from God and not, you know, your own doing. And yeah, I don't know. I to me that. That's something that is easy to lose sight of. And I have to kind of force myself to regularly take a step back and remind myself, you know, you may be dealing with these challenges, but look at all these things in your life that you have. Yes.
Yes. I think his recounting of all his blessings and his statement in verse 13 to my mind, is strongly reminiscent of Ecclesiastes. And the teaching of the preacher there that you can give your life to pursuing all of these things of the world, and in the end, you will be empty, and it will be entirely in vain. And I think it's useful to remember that, because Haman, definitely in this character, in this story, appears to be like a super villain. And yet, I think it's useful for us to remember that we don't have to be like an ethnic cleanser to fall into the same kind of problems. All we have to do is not read Ecclesiastes and seek to fulfill ourselves, or seek fulfillment in all of these worldly things. And if we don't seek fulfillment in God, then we're going to be saying the same. We're going to be saying verse 13.
And that's a great point. And you know, when I read Ecclesiastes, I'm struck by just how current its message is. I mean, if you look at the world around us, so many people are looking for meaning, and they're told by the culture, you know, you just, you know, work for success and, you know, accumulate things and your life will be good. And it's just not true, and they're empty, and you know, they want something, and it's, you know, it's still just, if anything, it's more relevant today, I think, than it was then.
We also see in Haman the value of a good spouse and a bad spouse. And, you know, I mean, I think we all have, and this is more a practical lesson for us too, I think we all have a tendency to sort of, you know, show our worst side to our spouse. We would say things to our spouse, you know, letting our emotions out, letting, you know, the way we feel about certain things to our spouse that we wouldn't do other people. And oftentimes it's because we think, well, our spouse will understand this and help. But sometimes our spouse does need to say, you're wrong. You know, and you can't even tell me that. You know, that sort of an attitude. And so Zeresh needed to be that person for him to say, you know, to correct him and let him know, you know, how, I guess, set him straight.
Yes, evidently she was not that type of spouse. So, but I mean, yeah, I mean, you see lots of juxtapositions in Esther like this. I mean, you get Mordecai and Haman are a classic juxtaposition. But you have Esther as the good wife that the king chooses, and then you have Zeresh as kind of the opposite example. And so, I think it's a good point. Yeah, and it would be interesting to know kind of the history and the backstory of Haman and his wife and his friends. And, you know, you might get a fuller picture of just how decisions about who to marry or who to hang out with can lead you down a path. I mean, it certainly can. Yeah, we'll see that these are something of fair weather friends, I would put it, and probably at least the friends, they strike me as kind of the sycophantic type that would be drawn to someone in a position of power, and not necessarily the kind of people you really want. So. Okay. All right. Well, let's move on to chapter 6. Mike, could I get you to read verses 1 through 9 of chapter 6, please?
That night the king did not sleep. So one was commanded to bring the book of the records of the chronicles, and they were read before the king. And it was found written that Mordecai had told him Bigthanah and Zeresh, two of the king's eunuchs, the doorkeepers who were about to lay hands on king Ahasuerus,
right, so we have this very interesting and irony-filled scene here. And a lot of the irony is driven by things that people don't know, either some people or all the people. So what are some of the things that people don't know that drive the action in this?
The king didn't know who the savior was.
Right. He evidently, I guess we don't know exactly why he didn't know this, but yeah, that's definitely one important example of hidden information. And you know, the fact that it gets revealed at this critical juncture, it doesn't strike me that that's likely to just be coincidence. So, what else? What other hidden information is there in this? Right. There's no indication that the king has any knowledge of this, and the fact that, as we'll see, what he ends up asking is, probably the last thing Haman would ever want to do. So that's good. What else? Yes. What was that? Yep. That's very obvious. Yeah, he's. Yeah, that's true.
He also learned about Mordecai at this point that he didn't basically do what Haman did and go tell everyone that, hey, look what I did. I saved the king's life by showing, by pointing out these two spies that wanted to kill him. So, or the king only read about it in the records that were kept there. So it's interesting that it's another investigation between Haman and Mordecai. Did you know if Haman discovered that?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great point. You know, there's no indication that Mordecai ever came and raised a fuss about the fact that he was never rewarded for this. And kind of it's a good example for us that, you know, just because you don't get noticed and rewarded for your efforts immediately, you know, doesn't mean that they're in vain. Anything else? That's true. God sees everything we do. I'm sure he saw what Mordecai was doing too. Yeah.
He also doesn't seem to realize that this issue of the issue of the Jew, because he refers to Mordecai as Mordecai the Jew. So he's so much honor by Mordecai the Jew, and yet months or some period earlier he gives his division of great authority to destroy him.
Yeah, I mean, that's a big hidden information. And nobody at this point, I think, or none of them know that Esther's a Jew, which is also going to, you know, come into play. So there's lots of things that either one person or other people don't know, and it leads to this very ironic situation here. So Haman assumes that this person who the king wants to honor, well, it must be him. Who could be wanted be honored more than him, even though there's no indication that he had done anything recently to be deserving of great honor for the king. So again, we see kind of the pride and the arrogance here. And he comes up with this very elaborate reward, spectacle. So a lot of it involves, you know, wearing the robes the king would wear, riding on the horse, the king's horse. What would that have signified then? I mean, my understanding is that it was kind of considered a great honor for someone to give you their clothes. Basically, it was like being made king for the day to be able to do this. So like a ticker tape parade or whatever the analog would be now. So I put in here the reference to Luke chapter 14 because it struck me as kind of an interesting parallel with Haman's actions here. So just looking at Luke chapter 14, starting in verse 7, it says, "When he noticed how the guests picked their places of honor at the table, he told them this parable. When someone invites you to a wedding feast, do not take the place of honor, for a person more distinguished than you may have been invited. If so, the host who invited both of you will come and say to you, 'Give this man your seat.' Then, humiliated, you will have to take the least important place. But when you are invited, take the lowest place, so that when your host comes, he will say to you, 'Friend, move up to a better place.' Then you will be honored in the presence of all your fellow guests. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted." So it's not, you know, an exact parallel to Haman's situation, but it reminds me that, you know, he's constantly wanting to get himself exalted, and shows very little humility. And as we'll see, you know, he ends up being humbled. And again, Haman is such an extreme case that it can be easy to not apply this to ourselves. But I do think we're in a culture that really encourages us to strive to promote ourselves and to kind of seek whatever recognition and honor we possibly can. So, yeah. Kind of a sad picture of the world, but yeah, I mean, I think you're right, and we shouldn't think that we're immune to this too. I mean, I think we all at times feel this temptation, and I know that I feel pressure. I mean, at my job, you know, they're one of the things they tell you to do to get ahead is, you know, look for ways to promote yourself, look for ways to kind of make sure that you get recognized for whatever you can. And it's a mindset, I think, that this prideful mindset that we can get caught up in. I think when I was looking at ways to kind of combat this, I was thinking in 1 Corinthians 4, when he's talking about the fact that, well, let me just read it. 1 Corinthians 4, verse 7. "For what makes you different from anyone else? What do you have that you did not receive? And if you did receive it, why do you boast as though you did not?" So again, it's this idea of where do all these things that we would boast about come from? Do they come from the fact that we're so awesome and that we, you know, are just better than everyone else? Or did they come from the way God has blessed us and I think keeping that mindset can help to avoid this temptation to kind of try to exalt yourself higher than you should. Right. Yeah, there's certainly nothing wrong with being successful or having talents. It can create these temptations, and we should be kind of aware of that and prepared to deal with that. But it's not the success and the ability and the talent that is the problem. That's not the problem. It's how you kind of react to it and who you give credit. credit for it.
And then you can knock in your talent on if they don't not have the right turn of mind, then you're not killing good with your brothers. So it didn't happen yet. Now we're supposed to feel good when our brothers have college that work, you know, makes feel good when college does well.
Yeah. Any other thoughts on how we can resist this? Yes? Well, they're in a culture that encourages that, and encourages you to think that it is all about you, and it's not necessarily even that it's coming from us, but if active resistance to that idea doesn't come from us, then they're going to get it from all these other places. The story in one of the picture books that you gave us? Okay, good. Okay. No, that is a great point. And thinking about being parents, this is not what you want your kids to be. And there are good role models, Esther, Mordecai, be like that. Don't be like Haman. So you can put that, over their bed. Don't be like Haman. Oh, any other thoughts on this? Okay. Where are we? Ron, can I get you to read the rest of chapter 6, so starting in verse 10 through the end of the chapter? Yes. All right, so here we're starting the downfall of Haman. He was all sure that he was going to be the one honored, and lo and behold, it was Mordecai. It wasn't Haman. And not only is Mordecai going to be honored, but Haman has to do it. Haman has to parade him around the city saying, "This is the man the king wants to honor." So, he is not at all pleased with this. And not only is he full of grief, but his friends then turn on him, then his wife. And instead of encouraging him, they tell him he's doomed. So very quick and abrupt turnaround here. We also see, again, the example of Mordecai here, that he's honored by the king, but there's no indication that he kind of lets it go to his head. We have the contrasting examples there. Oh, no. Well, and he assumed that it was him.
Yeah.
So anyone would have been bad. But Haman, I mean, for it to be Mordecai was probably a double whammy on him. So, yeah. From his perspective, yes, he had a very Haman-centric worldview. So. You get the feeling he did not have a good, well-grounded sense of self-worth. Even though he's very arrogant, at the same time, it's a fragile kind of pride. It's, you know, these little things will totally shake him and kind of undermine it all. So. All right. Well, we will wrap that up and start in on chapter 7, finish the downfall of Haman next week.